Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Hello, Nina Porzuki here. Patrick Cox has graciously and bravely handed over the podcast reins for the next few months while he's on assignment. First, a little housekeeping. There will be some bad words on this podcast, so tune in or tune out as you see fit. And I wanted to start with a little news about the news. Hollywood finally took note about The World, the big show. We got name-checked on this new season of Orange is the New Black. I don't really know what it means, but we kind of thought it was cool here in the newsroom. For those of you who don't watch, a middle-class woman, Piper, ends up in a federal prison. She always seems to be saying the wrong thing, like in this argument with Red, the Russian prison cook.
I thought that I was doing the right thing.
By lying? We read different children's books.
You know, many cultures value a person's dignity over the truth. In Korea, they actually call it kibun. I heard that on The World with Marco Werman.
In Russia, we call it bullshit.
Okay. I'll admit, we do stories about obscure terms, as you might know. But, we actually haven't done a story about the word kibun. So, the big show's Marco Werman sought to rectify that. He spoke with linguist and writer Erica Okrent. She writes about language and etymology for Mental Floss and The Week.
Well, I looked into it, and I found a lot of people talk about it as one of those untranslatable words. Mm. It's something that's very Korean. And that always makes me a little suspicious, because pretty much anything can be translated. What people really mean when they say that is it just can't be summed up in a single equivalent word. If you translate it directly, you'll get mood or feeling. That's what it means. But we have that too, good moods, bad moods. So what's different about kibun? What it is that it seems to be all bound up with ideas of social harmony, efforts to keep the good vibes going by letting people save face or not doing things that you know will disrupt their mood. There's some tight connection kibun is supposed to have with a person's personal sense of prestige and status, their place in the world. So it's not just whether you're grumpy or cheerful, it's your whole state of mind with respect to your place in the world.
So how have you seen it used? Like if two people are talking and one person is aware of their kind of space to the other person, their sense of kibun, does that work?
Yeah, there's big importance placed on being able to read other people's kibun, especially in the case of social superiors, of people you need to pay extra attention to. So, for example, if your boss is in a bad mood, you'll want to avoid going into his office to tell him some bad news, like sales are way down, or I just spilled coffee all over the expense reports or something. Now, we would want to avoid our boss in that case, too, because we don't want to go in there and make him grumpier or make him angry at us.
Right.
We're thinking about how it might affect us, you know, a shoot the messenger kind of thing. But with the concept of kibun, I think we're not just worried about making him grumpier or getting yelled at, but that we might actually be insulting him, this social superior, by being an agent of his mood disruption. So we'll do everything we can to let him save face by sparing him this insult of disrupting his mood.
Mm. Kind of a back down.
Well, if that means keeping important information away from him or even lying about it, that's just what you have to do to keep the good vibes going.
Where does the word kibun come from? Because I've checked into it a little bit, and there's some references to it being a Japanese word.
The word is in Japanese as well, but it's unclear whether one borrowed it from the other or they both borrowed it from another source. The etymological connections between Japanese and Korean are unclear. We don't have a lot of ancient sources because they wrote in Chinese characters. So we don't know a lot about the development of etymology, or at least not as much as we know about Indo-European languages. It means mood in both, but according to what I've seen, it has more cultural importance in this Korean culture. You see it a lot in business advice. You know, if you're doing business in Korea, you must be aware of kibun. But interestingly, I asked a Korean friend about this, And when I said kibun, I expected her to say, oh, yes, this is what it means in Korea. It's very important. Mm. But she just said, oh, it means your mood.
Oh.
What's so Korean about that? We have it here, too. So I think it might be kind of one of those business advice things that gets passed around so much that it's more known here as a Korean cultural thing than it actually is in Korea.
So if we wanted to sound as cool as Piper, give us a sentence using the word kibun.
Don't harsh my kibun, man.
Keep it as ambiguous as possible.
Yeah, that's what you've got to be avoiding at all times.
There you have it, kibun. Don't harsh my kibun. And in special news, I asked Erica Okrent to answer all of your etymological questions. So for the next few weeks, we're trying this as a little experiment. I want you to send me all of your questions about specific words. You can message me at the World in Words Facebook page, or you can call us. I started a hotline. You can call, leave a message, 617-903-8818. That's 617-903-8818. Okay, on to the rest of the podcast. And continuing with the Hollywood theme here.
Come on, get up and fight. Put your hands up, you lopsided bag of hay.
Now that's getting personal, Lion.
Well, I'll get you anyway, Pee-wee.
Shame on you!
What did you do that for? I didn't buy them.
No, but you tried to. It's bad enough picking on a straw man, but when you go around picking on poor little dogs...
Well, you didn't have to go and hit me, did you?
Why, you're nothing but a great big coward.
You're right, I am a coward.
As you could guess from The Wizard of Oz and that poor cowardly lion, we are talking about cowardice today on the pod. And I've got the world's Clark Boyd here to help me. Hi, Clark.
Hello, Nina. I promise I'm not terrified.
Thank you.
I'm a little terrified.
Just a little.
I understand a quiz is to be involved, so I'm
yes,
a little
exactly.
Nervous.
Well, you should be terrified. That's what I was going to say, because the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to test you. So we're talking cowardice. Okay, Clark, how many ways can you call someone a coward?
Oh.
Let's go through
like
the list.
Total ways you can call someone a
coward? Well, let's just go through some of the words
okay.
that...
Scaredy cat. Mm-hmm. Fraidy cat. Then there are these old-fashioned terms, which, like poltroon. One of my favorites is, this is really old, craven. If somebody was a coward in the old days, you called them a craven.
What about good old yellow-bellied?
Yellow-bellied...
Chicken. Here, I'm handing you this whole list.
You're doing so much better
exactly.
than me. Oh, these
well,
are all
I have
the synonyms.
I have a list. Oh. A list of synonyms.
Of course, chicken.
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 Wimp.
Quitter. Invertebrate. That's so good. Jellyfish is a good one. Malingerer. Ooh, I love that.
Shirker.
Wow. Pessimist. Are you kidding me?
It's a very sort of broad thesaurus.com. I got this on thesaurus.com.
Skulker.
Skulker.
Oh, yeah, there's dastard. That's a really old one. So, you know.
I think we use it more now as like an adjective,
yeah,
dastardly.
This is one of the interesting things is that all these words used to be common usage, like dastard would have been used. Like if you see old-fashioned movies from like the 1930s, you know, back when they had silent films, a lot of times somebody would be cowardly. It would pop up, you dastard. And you're like, what, really? Gutless. Gutless wonder. I've been called that a few times in my life, let me tell you.
So what got you so interested in the topic of cowardice?
I got to be honest with you, Nina. This is just one of these things. You know, in this office, there are at least, like, what, 150?
I would say, like, 400.
400, then,
books.
Review copies of books sitting out there. And we can take them if we want to. We donate them sometimes. And I'm walking along. And I see this yellow covered book, of course. And it just says, Cowardice, A Brief History. And I think it's my just weird sense of humor. And I'm like, okay, profiles and courage. That's one thing. But somebody actually wrote a book about cowardice? You
got to
be kidding me. The opposite. And I picked it up. And immediately I was just fascinated with it, because as I started to read it and as the author, Chris Walsh, starts to bring up all of these examples, and a lot of it's literary. He reaches back into our favorite characters from literature. And I just realized some of my favorite characters from literature are the biggest cowards on the planet.
What does that say about you, Clark? we won't go there.
Probably best not to look too deeply into that.
So, Clark, you actually talked to Chris Walsh, and then you talked a little bit on The Big Show with Aaron Schachter about your conversation with him.
Actually, Nina, I was too scared to go over to Boston University. I asked him to come here.
Really?
Yeah, no, he came here. And the funny part is that he shows up wearing a yellow shirt.
He's all in.
He's all in. And I started off asking him the same question you asked me. Why write a book about cowardice?
A lot of people have written about courage, but nobody's written about cowardice.
And he told me this great story about his first stop was the Library of Congress card catalog.
Under history cowardice, there is one title, which makes me the preeminent researcher in the field. So I've got that going for me. I can found the field of cowardice studies. I know there'd be departments everywhere now.
Well, Mr. Walsh there seems to have a pretty good sense of humor about the whole cowardice thing. And as he says, without much source material, how did he even go about defining the term?
So what he ends up doing in the book is coming to this definition, which is cowardice is a failure of duty because of excessive fear. And part of what he's getting at there is kind of the etymology of the word itself, cowardice. And he goes back and traces it to a Latin root, cauda, which meant tail. So you're thinking turn tail. It's all about the – so you can see how the word came to be used.
Now, going back there seems a bit archaic, right? Somehow, though, the word coward seems to have made a comeback, as we said, used to refer to the Boston Marathon bombers.
Yeah, it was a term that was used quite a lot, especially in sort of the Civil War era. It kind of fell out of favor. But then he does some interesting Google graphing to sort of map instances of the use of the word. What he's seen is that after 9/11, the use of the word cowards and cowardice has kind of spiked again. And you can think, because there were a lot of people at the time who labeled the 9/11 bombers cowards.
I guess the idea is that people are going after soft targets. They're not fighting a fair fight, and that makes them cowards.
Exactly. And Chris Walsh had this to say about the rebirth of that word in the context of 9/11.
The idea that these terrorists were cowards can give us confidence and maybe a false sense of confidence that, well, if we just attack them, then they'll be subdued, and that not attacking them would be cowardly.
The interesting thing about that, Aaron, that he notes is that Osama bin Laden was using very similar rhetoric on the other side. He would often call out the United States
for being cowards,
you know, for using drones, for fleeing from places like Somalia or Beirut when things got tough. So it really worked both ways.
So it does seem that this term coward in whatever form is fairly universal. And other cultures also feel it to be a pretty big insult.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you look through some of the placards that were being carried on the streets of Paris after the Charlie Hebdo attacks earlier this year, the words that stood out were coward, chicken. All those sorts of words that we'd also use in English were also being used in France as well.
So, Clark Boyd, is there anything worse than being a coward, do you think?
Well, according to Chris Walsh, there are sort of levels of cowardice that we're talking about here. A lot of times we think of a coward as the person who knows the right thing to do but then is too afraid to do it. He said there's actually a worse one than that, and that's not even bothering to figure out what the right thing to do is. But, and this is what I really love as the takeaway from this book, is his point ultimately is that we might berate cowards, we might look down upon cowardice, but it actually serves a purpose in our lives.
Cowardice actually has a kind of everyday usefulness that courage doesn't. We don't need to necessarily be courageous, but we do need to not be cowardly.
In other words, the fear of being a coward compels us to actually get things done.
You know, I was thinking, and this maybe a gross rationalization, that coward sometimes could be a good thing. You know, you don't go into a fight because you're afraid of the result, but, you know, you've escaped a fight.
Well, and that's actually his point in the book. And he points to the fact that in Stuttgart, in Germany, there is now a monument to the deserters of every war.
but on the other hand, at the time, might have been called cowards.
Absolutely. So the idea is always in flux.
So it occurred to me the good things about being a coward, and I was just curious, like, what is the real difference between self-preservation and cowardice? Like, did you have that discussion?
Yes. I mean, this is just it. You know, one person's coward is another person's, you know, bravest person in the world. And Chris Walsh made the point by looking at how attitudes have changed toward conscientious objectors. Conscientious objectors, like, say, during the Civil War, were definitely branded as cowards. Mm. Conscientious objectors, when we get to Vietnam, the Vietnam War,
it was definitely mixed.
There was a whole segment of the population that saw them as cowards still, and then a whole segment of the population that, you know, put them up on a pedestal and said they're actually courageous for not going to fight in that war. He mapped it out at the beginning of the book as sort of what he calls the vice, virtue, vice continuum.
Right.
Right. So on the one vice end of the continuum, you're a complete coward. Your fear is overwhelming and you're completely reckless. The other end of the vice continuum is you're almost too courageous, right? You've got too much self-confidence and you're too eager to go in and take care of business. So in a weird way, sort of the courage stuff comes right in the middle. You have just the right amount of fear. You're being compelled to do something. And you're morally right to do it as well. It's all relative. It's all completely relative.
Right. One example I saw that he talked about, which is quite controversial, is the idea of suicide.
Yeah.
Which in some circumstances, some people consider like a great, you know, courageous act. Mm-hmm. Like I think about is Japanese, the samurai warriors that like
exactly
kill themselves and it's a great courageous act. And then the other end of it is suicide is the most cowardly thing that one can do. So
yeah,
I mean
think of the Catholic Church's usual teachings on this sort of thing. And, you know, it's like under any circumstances, suicide is one of the most horrible mortal sins that you can commit. Having said that, look at how attitudes are changing towards that, though, for terminally ill patients.
Right, assisted suicide.
So, you know, again, we're always in that gray area, and these things are always in flux, both sort of culturally and linguistically.
What is not gray, but is yellow, is the association between cowardice and the color yellow.
Chris Walsh kind of traces it back to, and this makes total sense when you think about it, people who are scared, who are being cowardly, maybe, will urinate themselves.
Huh.
So that's where the yellow comes.
Literally yellow.
Well, so literally yellow.
Wow. And
it seems like, you know, it's not only yellow. Again, we get back to the whole gut thing. Gutless.
Yellow-bellied.
You know, because you will not only urinate yourself, but people who are scared will often defecate themselves as well. So I am scared shitless. Literally.
It occurs to me that it's actually our body being protective. Yes. Like it's another self-preservation mechanism, right? You don't have enough. Your gut is full. You need to get away fast. You release everything in your gut. You go.
Fight or flight.
Fight or flight.
It's a fight or flight response. And, you know, I think Chris would agree with this. It's like until each one of us is faced with that situation, you can talk all you want to, but you never know whether you're going to fight or whether you're going to flee.
And you also don't know, like, whether fighting is the cowardly act or fleeing is the cowardly. Like, that's yeah. also sort of a relative.
Yeah. If I could just add one more thing
right.
About Chris's book, which I really appreciated, it's not just about war and about warriors and courage or cowardice in battle. He goes into other aspects of cowardice as well. And I think this is one of the reasons that I love the book so much is because he referenced great characters from literature who I just have always loved.
All those cowards that you really
love. All those cowards that I really, Yossarian and Catch 22.
Clark, you just...
I know. But my favorite is the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock by T.S. Eliot because I had to do an entire paper on that poem in college, but I've always been a huge fan of T.S. Eliot. That poem in particular. And the main character of that poem is really cowardly.
It's been a long time since I've actually read that poem, heard that poem. You have a copy.
I have the little bit that I think highlights.
Great.
J. Alfred is a real coward when it comes to doing much of anything. So there's this part of the poem where he's talking to himself, and indeed there will be time to wonder, do I dare? And do I dare? time to turn back and descend the stair with a bald spot in the middle of my hair. They will say how his hair is growing thin, my morning coat, my collar mounting firmly to the chin, my necktie rich and modest but asserted by a simple pin. They will say, but how his arms and legs are thin. Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute, there is time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse. Ugh. Oh, he's such a coward. You just want to scream at him.
Just do it.
You know, I have to say that, you know, at least whenever I start feeling like I'm a little bit cowardly, I go back and read the Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock again, and I'm like, dude, you got to do something. Act.
When in doubt, go to Prufrock.
When in doubt, go back to
Prufrock. The proof is in the Prufrock.
Exactly.
Thanks so much, Clark, for coming on today.
You're welcome, Nina. Oh, one last thing. I'll leave the podcast listeners with this.
Sweet.
There's lots of stuff that you can't get into the full interview that goes on the big show. And in this case, one of my favorite things is that when Chris Walsh came in, he had just had his book release party the night before. And he and a buddy debuted this song about cowardice.
Oh, they were brave enough to
debut. They were brave enough to get up and perform the song. So this is a song called Cowardice. Words by Chris Walsh. Music by his buddy Chandler Travis.
You were scared of the first kiss. I'm scared of the last. Together we could teach our class in the history of cowardice. The history of cowardice.
And that's all for today. I'm on Twitter at Korzuki. Or you could visit the World in Words Facebook page. Leave a comment. I'm not afraid. Well, actually, maybe just a little. Thanks so much, and I will be back soon.
I was crashing into trees. Now I'm afraid of turning. Afraid you'll hide from me. My heart was in a freeze. But now the tree's burning.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Exploring the Human Endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.